The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia, and thank you very much for joining us. I'm Laura Kovacs, and I'm honored to be here. The author and co-author of 17 previous books, Tracy Lewis Jiggetts, is a professor of English and Black Studies at the Community College of Philadelphia, host of the podcast Heart Talk, and the founder of Heart Space, a healing community for those who have experienced trauma. Her new essay collection is a celebration of Black joy as a means of restoration, resilience, and resistance. Tonight, she'll be joined in conversation with Bernice McFadden, winner of the American Book Award and the NAACP Image Award for outstanding literary work for The Book of Harlan, among much other work. Thank you both so much for joining us. The screen is all yours.
Thank you, Laura. Tracy, Bernice. Happy Pub Day to you.
Thank you.
Book 18. Congratulations. Yeah. That's wonderful.
Thank you so much. I'm so grateful. Just full today.
I'm full right along with you. So let's just jump right on in.
Sure.
I found Black Joy to be a remarkable collection. One that spoke to me in a very intimate way. It was like sitting with one of my sisters and listening to these stories. So thank you for this gift. I'd like to know what the motivation was behind this book, and why do you think it was necessary to birth it into the world at this time?
Oh, thank you for saying that. First of all, you know, I always tell everyone that I have favorite writers. And so you are one of the ones that I just hold up to such, just in the light all the time. I'm so grateful that I get a chance to talk to you. So thank you so much. Black Joy came from my own journey of trying to figure out what joy felt like in my body. Thinking about grief and carrying grief and trauma, I had a therapist who said to me, Tracy, you know, what does joy feel like to you? And at my big age of 40 something, I couldn't answer her. And I knew that I had joy moments, but like, I couldn't pinpoint what it actually felt like, nor could I access it, you know, at any time. So that began just a long journey of, you know, self-awareness, trying to figure out what it felt like. And I talk about this in the book, I had this moment of watching a popular nighttime drama television show and like feeling my body energized. And, you know, as a storyteller, like we are, you know, captured by good story, right? Like, and we're drawn to it and, you know, all of the layers and everything. So I was just sitting in the room like like that, and my husband walks in and he's like, don't know what's happening here. You should be alone. So I took a moment and took a beat and like noticed how my body was feeling, and I was just like, had this revelation, like, oh, this is what joy feels like. And I took a snapshot, you know, a mental snapshot, a screenshot of that, and brought it back to my therapist. And my therapist was like, now you have a point of reference. You know what it feels like in your body. And so when you are in, you know, your state of anxiety, or, you know, triggered, your PTSD is triggered, or you're dealing with grief or any of those things, you have something you can access now. It does not mean it's going to take it away, but it can right size you when you're feeling like you're falling. So then that just, you know, that became me just paying attention, right? And swinging with my daughter or dancing with my daughter in the rain and like just really grabbing hold of these moments of joy. And of course, as someone who's a writer, I started writing about it. And that led, that just, you know, kind of snowballed into what we have here today.
Have you met other people in your life who have not experienced joy in the way that you discovered it?
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. And I think simultaneously, and I know you appreciate this because I know like the work, you know, how you approach your writing, we've talked about that, is that simultaneously while I'm discovering joy, I'm doing a lot of genealogical work and I'm unpacking, you know, I found my third great grandmother, you know, in the plantation where she was held captive, right? And I just began to kind of sit with her and sit with those generations and thinking about my mother and thinking about my grandmother. I apologize, I think there's like the fan situation going on my computer. But like, you know, sitting with that and trying to discover joy and trying to remember where I seen it, right? Uh-huh. And realizing that it's always been there for all of us, all of these women in my family, but accessing it or accepting it had been a challenge, right? With its trauma and pain and hardship seemed to be the most familiar, right? And so yeah, I have seen people who weren't able to tap into like the somatics of it, like the embodied piece of it.
I think this is going to be a guide for them to do that. Why was it important for you to birth this book into the world at this moment? Because we are living in precarious times.
Absolutely. You know what? I wanted to use what I was discovering, my personal story, as an entry point to look at the way Black folks as a collective have wielded joy, right? How we've used joy. And I know the catchphrase nowadays is Black joy is resistance, right? Like that's what we hear. And it absolutely positively is. But even more so what I've discovered, I think the emphasis that this book has is that it's been the mechanism, it's been the mode for healing, right? It's been the way that we've healed, you know, ourselves in the midst of everything that's going on in the world. And I think that is incredibly important for the time that we're in now, between a global pandemic, you know, racial unrest and uprisings and protests and, you know, voting rights acts, you know, like all of that, right? It's chaos that's happening around us. Yet in the middle of a protest in Philadelphia, somebody gets married and somebody starts singing and somebody starts dancing. And we've been doing that, right? There's an essay in the piece called, you know, we've been known, right? We've been knowing how to do this, right? But we just didn't have the language, right, around it. We didn't necessarily have, you know, nobody was talking about, you know, grandmama rocking in church and that's bilateral stimulation, right? And she's actually moving trauma through her body by rocking back. Nobody's framing it that way, because why would we? Mm-hmm. But that's what it is. And so I'm hoping that this would be a balm, or, you know, something that would people can connect to their own lives, like connect to their own story. It's like, oh yeah, I've seen that before. Oh yeah, that I've been through that. And that's kind of like how I deal with joy or not deal with joy, right? And begin the conversation. So that to me is like the most important gift I could give.
Oh, and we're very grateful.
Thank you.
Would you share an excerpt with us?
Yes, please. I will. So I started that off with a, you know, sort of like the standard from the introduction kind of thing that I was going to read, because I thought that's what I was supposed to do, but I'm a little rebellious. So I was sitting quiet waiting for this to get started, and I just felt an overwhelming presence. And I feel like it's probably best to start with something else that speaks to that presence. This is a piece titled I've Got Dreams to Remember Granny. Un Viaggio in Cinque Parti, which is Italian for journey in five parts. My granny called me Petey. I can hear her raspy elongation of the E vowel in my head even now. How's my sweet Petey? It simultaneously unravels and soothes my soul to hear those words pierce the dimensions of heaven and earth, the rivers of gold she crossed more than 11 years ago. The story goes that the name stuck because my pint-sized self would run around her house screaming over and over again, "For Pete's sake, Granny!" I don't know where I got it. I suppose it was one of those phrases that just tasted good to the toddler palate. I'm sure the staccato sharpness of Pete tickled my little fancy and sounded like something an adult would respond to with laughter and kisses. And so I added the phrase to my growing repertoire of phrases like "Mommy said," and "I want applesauce." I spoke very early, and much of that can be attributed to my granny. She was my sitter for the first 3 years of my life while my mom went to work, and she did not do baby talk. She spoke to me with the same tone and tenor and mostly the same language she used with Miss Violet, one of her Uber fly girlfriends who came over to smoke cigarettes and drink beer with her. Miss Violet was a beautiful woman whose face stayed beat to the gods, as makeup artists say today. Granny and Miss Violet would cackle about men, and there was usually one in particular who would occupy at least a portion of their conversations, Victor Newman. Victor was the ruthlessly vicious yet debonair lead character on the soap opera The Young and the Restless. Yes, Victor and Marvin Gaye and Smokey Robinson were always in the mix with the ordinary Oscars and regular Richards. I at once knew all this, and I didn't. I was 2, maybe 3 years old, so my witness is probably not the best. Do I really even know what my granny and her girlfriends were talking about? Maybe not. But I did the math, and she was 39 when I was born, several years younger than I am now. So I'm quite sure that they weren't talking about Mighty Mouse or the Romper Room. And when blood memory jumps wildly in my veins whenever I hear a Sam Cooke or Supremes or Aretha Franklin record, when Otis Redding croons "I've Got Dreams to Remember," I know for sure they weren't. I mostly just recall the laughter, the way they'd unleash whoops and hollers that would soar through the room and wrap me up in joy. I'm grown now, so of course I know the backstories, the divorces and wayward children, the job losses and gains. Granny's house was filled with the generationally familiar prepackaged happiness, the laughter, whether from a kiki with her girls or a raucous win at backgammon, was never a surprise. It was a known glee. Granny was neither spontaneous nor vulnerable then, mostly because life wouldn't allow her to be. Bouts with depression had long snatched Granny's breeze from under her wings. She chose her own sovereignty and preferred her happy to be one of her own design. Even better if it came in a bottle or pill or mink coat. Her concept of freedom and happiness would always be the glamorous shade of red that offered a quick pop of color against the stark drabness of life. It could never, ever be the whole picture. But back then, to my three-year-old heart, her laughter just sounded like love and safety. Her presence energized my little body. Every moment creating neural pathways my soul would need to hold on to when life went left. The evenings watching Star Trek on the couch tucked under her arm. The days watching her paint the ceramic figurines she'd spun and carved herself. My three-year-old self sucking on the fatty gristle of the T-bone steak she made every week. The smell of Sterling beer and Virginia Slim cigarettes. The coffee mugs with cherry red lipstick stains and the clanking of silver hoop earrings and bangles. Right there in her Bent Creek apartment, I first felt the power of a kind of joy, even if sporadic and disjointed, that fights off demons with skill and style. I was Viola Brown's grandchild. And she loved me.
Ooh, that was beautiful.
Thank you.
Thank you. Do you need a minute? You need a...
I'm okay.
Tracy, there's so much reflection in these pages. I want to know what perspectives or beliefs have you challenged with this work?
Ooh, Bernice, Bernice, Bernice. So much related to my own understanding of faith and spirituality. I from the age of 11 on, I grew up in the Black Baptist Church in Louisville, Kentucky, right? And there's so much good there, right? Like, I have grace for the elders and the people that kind of laid the foundation of my understanding of the divine. There was also a lot of things that could be categorized as respectability politics or, any other, language that's used nowadays, right? But we just really internalized racism and misogyny kind of wrapped in, theology. And so I've been challenged by that. I've been challenged about how I'm able to hold my faith and my spirituality, and also deconstruct or detach from the things that are no longer useful. Like my great grandmother used to say, take the meat and spit out the bones, right? And so I think that is evident in the book. There are conversations that I have with myself in the book about the language of deconstruction or the language of faith and spirituality. So that's one piece. I think also my understanding of a Black woman, my role, so to speak, as a Black woman, my identity as a Black woman has shifted and changed in the process of writing this book. In ways that I did not expect. What I want my daughter to see, what I want her to know about what it means. The book is dedicated to her because there's a level of freedom in her that I see that feels unattainable to me. And I can on one hand say I've given her the space to be that. On the other hand, I can long for that too. And so just wrestling with that, the ideas that I had about, who I am and what I'm supposed to be have been challenged through the writing of this book in a good way, I think, in a way that's going to spur on my evolution. So yes. I think that's like to be continued.
Thank you for that. Now, I'm going to read a passage. Ooh. This jumped out at me.
Okay.
And I've read it a few times.
Okay.
When we choose Blackness, which as I've stated here might mean choosing unacceptance, it's glorious. When we decide to wrap our arms tight around what Blackness means to us, hold it, love it, and yes, even interrogate it, then we snatch that construct out of the hands of those who thought they had the power to use it to make us inferior. We say, give me that Blackness and let me show you what I will do with it. Let me roll it between my fingers and in my mind. Let me set your intentions on fire and create something new, something that as colonizers, you'll desperately want later on. Let me create the baseline that holds your national melody together. I see you coming to steal it, but as soon as you do, I'll flip it again and you will need to overhaul your systems just to catch up. I will turn my gospel into blues, into jazz, into R&B, into rock, into funk, into disco, into hip hop. You'll look back over entire industries, and when you remove the mask, you'll only see our joy behind the creativity. We will lean into your non-acceptance, no matter how much it hurts, because deep down we know that on your best day, you could never. We're sad if you don't like or love us. We're not sad if you don't like or love us. We have our oyster knives. I love that nod to Zora. Mm-hmm. When did you choose Blackness?
I think that I have been always choosing Blackness with whatever understanding I had in a particular moment, right? I remember being in high school. Actually, if you pull out my yearbook from senior year, next to my name, it says little X, right? I always had this very militant, you know, and I don't know, you know, they called it militant, but I don't know it was that. It was just an understanding of and celebration of who I was as a Black person. Still with all the stuff, right? I just talked about like being in the church and all, like still with all the limited understanding, but seeking, constantly seeking to understand who I was as a Black woman. And that, you know, went to college and that developed at, you know, hanging out. I'll never forget, I'm talking to Frank X. Walker on Friday because I used to hang out in the King Cultural Center in these in this small room that was in the back, and they had all of these books, the Zora Neale Hurston, like all of these books. And I was just like, oh, it was like I was breathing in all of them, right? Still with issues, right? Still with major issues around wanting to be accepted, right? Wanting, hyper aware of the gaze, like that Toni Morrison talks about the white gaze, right? Like hyper aware of it and wanting to, you know, somehow be Black, but and also like, you know, have this acceptance. And, you know, moving, leaving the bluegrass, they leave in Kentucky and going to Chicago and going to New York and going to Philly, going into these metropolitan areas where, you know, Black folks are Black folks, right? And you know, observing, taking it in. So I've always been choosing Blackness from the very beginning. I just had a memory of my mom. You know, my mom had Essence magazine and Ebony magazine and Song of Solomon. That's a book I specifically remember because it had a yellow cover on it, and it was Song of Solomon. And I'm literally maybe 10, right? I had no business. There I am trying to read, you know? So there was this hunger to see myself outside of the paradigms, outside of like whiteness. Mm-hmm. But then hearing, oh, you gotta go get a good job. Oh, you gotta go, and hearing that language and trying to make sense of it. I think it was within the last decade, I'd say in the last 10 years, where I tell people all the time, my code switching button is broken. Like, I don't know if it works. And I mean, maybe it works. I don't know if it works anymore. You know, especially working in academia, like it don't work. Y'all gonna get all of this, you know? So, you know, I think within the last decade or so, just because it's exhausting, number mm-hmm. one, it's exhausting to trying to constantly be accepted by an entity. And to be clear, you know, I probably shouldn't even give this disclaimer, but I'm not talking about individuals. I'm talking about the collective, right? To be accepted by a collective that really has no intention of accepting me in the fullness of who I am. That's my hair. That's my body. That's my, you know, the way I speak. You know, if I drop a G at, you know, you know, whatever, you're not really interested in making that, normalizing any of that. So mm-hmm. why am I trying?
Right.
Right. And the joy I have is something that I found in stopping trying. Now, I say all of that, but I also recognize that that is a kind of a privileged standpoint, because there's some people that, you know, look, I got to take this job. I got kids to feed, you know what I'm saying? And so I'm going to do what I got to do to, you know, make do. Right. Mm-hmm. I think for me, in my circumstances, in my situation, I just got tired of making do, because making do felt such a compromise to my spirit and to my soul. And again, I'm a work in progress. So I will be choosing Blackness every day and every iteration of that as I learn more, as I gain more. Like I said, the genealogical work has blown my mind.
Yes.
You know, when I think about my third great grandmother on a plantation outside of Wilmington, North Carolina, and what she must have seen and how she must have lived, but then how they ended up, when I think about how they ended up in Kentucky or how they ended up in these in Virginia and all of these different places and the journeys that they, like, it's blown my mind and it's given me a new dimension to my Blackness that I didn't have before I took the DNA test and it told me that my people was the Yoruba people from, you know, Nigeria, yes. Right? Yes. Or, you know, before I took, you know, before I started to do that work. So I don't know if I answered your question.
Yes, you did.
But I am choosing, actively choosing. I think we have to. I think, especially if you're in the Western hemisphere, you have to choose Blackness every single day.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like when you are sitting down, looking at these documents that have to do with your family, that you're not just looking at them, that you're having the experience and you're having the conversations with them? That's how I feel. I'm always yeah. having a conversation with an ancestor. And I listen to them because they do guide me in the right direction.
Yes. I mean, I'm at the beginning of that journey. And I think in the beginning, I had to set it aside because it freaked me out a little bit. You know, I believe in the power of the great cloud of witnesses, right? Like, I believe in their presence. But as I began to see the documents that 14-year-old, you know, sold for $500, like when I started looking at those documents, something else happened. And I am in the process of making sense of it. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I'm making sense of it, if I've made sense of it yet. And I think I'm in the process of embracing those conversations because they have something to say.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely.
I think it's probably connected to my next piece of writing, Bernice. And I'm just like, ah!
So before we started speaking in front of the audience, mm-hmm. we had a very tiny conversation. And this is book 18. Mm-hmm. And you said you feel as nervous as you did with book one.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like you to elaborate on that.
You know, exactly 20 years ago, 2002, I put together this little chapbook of poetry called Collapsed on the Wings of a Sigh, a compilation of poems I'd written over the years. And I couldn't see Black Joy. There's no way I could have saw Black Joy. And I would say that I am even more nervous than I was at book one. I think book one, I didn't know what I was doing. So I was just doing it, you know? There was a free, I was liberated in a way that I'm trying to access now, right? Because I just did it. I just put my work out in the world. Like, I just did it. And like, you like it, great. If you don't, okay. You know, I've probably been jaded a little bit about by the industry in a lot of ways. And so I have a lot of preconceived notions. I spent a lot of time as an independent, had my own publishing company, published other folks, published my work. I did, published with a small independent press, one book. And then I've been doing a lot of collaborations with high profile folks. But Black Joy is like my first venture out into what some would call mainstream. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I hear a lot of, it's your time, it's your time, it's your season. And I receive that wholeheartedly. And also, I feel I'm still wrestling with feeling deserving of it and feeling worthy of it. And, you know, and I've had people say, like, you've been doing this for 20 years. You know, I've sat in your classes before. You've taught, you know, in Philly, and I've gleaned from you, and I've gleaned from so many of the writers that I absolutely love that make me want to throw my laptop out the window because y'all just so damn good at what you do. But I just kept going because I feel called to this, right? I feel called. And I also think that I am particularly nervous now because so much of me is in this book. So much of my story is in this book. I bled on them pages.
I believe it.
And that's, you know, that's different for me than writing fiction. It's different than, you know, writing an essay or a reported piece or something like that. Like memoir or autobiographical essays or personal essays, it's an entirely different ballgame. I'm exposing myself to the world. And I'm saying, I don't need your acceptance.
Right.
But I'm in a business that needs everybody that's listening to go buy the book, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
How do I hold that, you know? So I think that's where I am now.
It's a difficult balance, I think.
Yeah.
I feel that, because, you know, I'm working on my memoir right now, and I've written about these women who raised me, and that was easy. Mm-hmm. And now the last section is about myself, and I've written about myself hiding. I've written about myself under the guise of fictional characters.
Yes.
So just to say, well, you know, I did this and this. It's very difficult because I feel like I don't care what you think, but the little girl inside of me is like, I care. So it's, it's terribly difficult, but you did it.
Yeah,
I saw some of the blood on the pages and the tears. And I think that's what makes a really phenomenal piece of work is the truth and the honesty. I'm all about truth and honesty, and I could always tell when a writer is not being completely truthful. Like, I'm like, don't dip your toe in, jump in.
Yeah.
That's it.
And I'm glad you said that, because that is where I was. I felt like all of my other kind of transparent writings, the blogging that I did, was like the dipping of the toe, testing the waters.
Right.
You know what I mean? And this, I committed, I said, I want to hold the truth sacred. I wanted my POV to be my POV, and I want to go all in. And, you know, I did my best to do that, and it was scary. I remember reading a piece to my husband, and he was like, "Are you sure?" I mean, you want to put that out there? He's like, "It couldn't be me, but go ahead." You know, and it was a piece about my first love, and you know, so he's like, "That's a lot," you know. But I think intention matters, right? Like, I think if I was writing, and I've seen, you know, I know you've seen it, I've seen this where, you know, people are writing to spill the tea, right? And or, you know, to revenge writing, right? Like, I'm gonna get back at everybody who hurt me. I tried my best to hold space for and grace for anyone in my life that may have harmed me, but who, you know, indirectly I needed to tell the story. And that was not easy for me at all. But I tried.
So you wrote it out. You wrote it out the way it was, right? The way it happened, how you feel. But the writing is in the rewriting.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So in the rewriting, you know, that's when I got to reframe. And that's where the reflection happens. Like, that's what I realized. Like, that's where I got you know, the revelations about certain circumstances was in the rewriting. You know, I can dump it on the page, absolutely put all of the righteous rage that I had on the page. But then when I went to, you know, work on it, I was able to see some stuff that I would not have been able to see if I had just left it there, right?
Yeah.
And so I think that's important also, for real.
You have to step away. So we've got some questions. Madam Donna Hill is in the house.
Hey!
And she asked, being this is a personal story, how did you manage to have your truths edited for publication? So you kind of sort of answered that, but it goes through your own personal editing, but there are other eyes on the page. So how
Yeah,
did
I mean, the beautiful thing, like I said, I had, I don't know, I don't want to say it's a unique experience because I surely hope it was not unique, but I had a really wonderful editor who was a white woman, Carrie Marcus, great editor.
I know
Who,
Kevin.
yeah, oh yeah,
That's
you know,
right. He's a wonderful editor, yes.
what she said to me is like, I'm not going to pretend to know the experiences of a black woman. So she actually brought in someone who worked at, you know, as an editor to sit, you know, and there were like phrases where she would correct and they were like, oh no, she means, you know, she fine, you know.
We've come a long way for you to have that experience. We have come a long way.
Wow. That and I was actually shocked because you know I'd listened to everyone who had told me be conscious. I was prepared to defend, you know, and you know I was fortunate enough where I was able to tell my story pretty much the way that I wanted to tell it, you know, minus just some like craft type of things and organizational kinds of things. And I'm so grateful for that because I do know that that's not something that is always the case for folks. So I feel like I was sheltered. I think the reason why I had to read the piece about my grandmother, because I feel like Vi been in the process all along in some way. And she may have told somebody like, listen, don't mess with my baby. You know, so I didn't, I, you know, I had a, I didn't have a lot of. Now, if the question is around my fears of someone else reading my stuff, there was a lot of that. But I figured like hopefully thousands of people are going to be reading it. So if I can't get around past it, huh?
Tens
There you
of
go.
thousands.
Tens of thousands of people are going to be reading it, so I better get used to it.
Bonnie's question is, what other writers do you see Black joy in that speaks to you? That's a great question.
Well, I'm talking to one.
Thank you.
I am talking like I'm always like, you know, I believe in giving people their flowers while they're here. And you know, we've lived these last few years where we've seen what can happen when we don't do that. So I always people are like, you know, what book would you tell me to read to really kind of Gathering of Waters, Glorious, Book of Harlan? Like these are the standards. I think Jesmyn Ward is amazing.
Yes.
And just the beauty of the language. It's like I'm black, so I'm reading it like I'm listening to a good song, like like yes, you know, you gotta do that, you know. Anyway, I mean, there's the godmother, Toni Morrison. I was, you know, almost excited about her short story book coming out.
I came today.
Mine came today too. You know, and I was like, oh, is that a sign? It came the same day as my book came out, you know.
There are connections everywhere.
Absolutely. I received that. Yeah, so I mean, if I mean, I hate naming names because there's so many people out there that I think that are just brilliant. But yeah, I'll just leave it at that.
Nicole asks, you talked about your daughter and your family history. How do you share that with her, and what do you hope she does with that information in the future when she thinks about her family?
I haven't talked, to be honest, my daughter's 10, so I have not talked a lot about like the backstories, right? About my family and just our history as women in our family. But I said this yesterday to someone that I had a vision or kind of an imagining of my daughter at 25, and she's reading Black Joy maybe for the first time because she can't read it now. I mean, I need to hold on to something for a second. But although she's begging me, she begs me every day to read it. But I have this vision of her reading it at 25 and just feeling a sense of like place, and feeling a sense of wholeness in a way that maybe she hadn't experienced prior to that. And as she matures and grows, I absolutely will be sharing with her the story because I think that's the disconnect, right? Like many Black folks grew up where silence was normalized, where hiding was normalized, where you didn't talk, air your dirty laundry, you don't talk about what goes in this house stays in this house, don't you say nothing out, and so I don't want to perpetuate that. I want her to see that it's okay to share her heart and to share her story. And so that I hope that I can get to that place where I can really talk to her about it when she gets older.
And she's 10.
She's 10.
You might have to break down by the time she's 12 and let her read the book. Were you censored? Did your parents censor you? Censor the literature when you was a
I think they
kid?
tried to. Like I said, I read everything. It didn't matter. My mom had Essence, Cosmopolitan, Toni Morrison, whatever was on Alice Walker, The Color Purple, you know what I'm saying? Like whatever. And I snuck and read it. And now in hindsight, I low key think that my mom knew that I was reading it, and it was just let it ride because, she's reading. But I was censored in other ways. Like I mean, I grew up, by the time I was in middle school, it was heavily in the church. So, that's not no fingernail polish, no makeup, what are you listening to? That music, you shouldn't be listening to that hippity hippity hop, And meanwhile, I got earphones on the bus listening to NWA, like, Strawberry, Strawberry was the neighborhood. So yeah, I don't censor her. I just think that I have to ready myself for the questions.
Yes, that is true. Oh, okay. So Tennille asks, what is on your Black Joy playlist?
Ooh, All the things. I mean, can you have a Black Joy playlist and not have like a Frankie Beverly and Maze?
Absolutely
I
not.
mean, like, does that even like, so like old school or what they would call old school, Frankie Beverly and, I mean, everything. I put together actually a Black Joy playlist on, I gotta kind of figure that out because it's on Spotify. And so I don't know what I'm gonna do about that now. But it was everything from Miles Davis and jazz to and Bitches Brew to Frankie Beverly and Maze and Marvin Gaye to early hip hop, right? Like LL and Eric B and Rakim to Beyonce, because I just feel like whatever you think about her, she gonna have to be on the playlist, right? To newer artists that are coming out now that are maybe not as known. There's a song, and gosh, I forgot her name, called "I Am Enough" that I just play over and over again. I've been playing it all over again in this last week to remind myself that I am enough. All genres, because as you read, Bernice, we own all the genres.
Yes, we do. Yes.
So I have all of it is black.
Okay, Katrina, your experiences and sentiments with your daughter and your granny deeply resonates with me. I share deeply in that Black joy. I have a son and three grandsons. What are your thoughts about the male experiences and conversations of Black joy?
Yeah, I think that I don't want to say even more so, but equally, I think Black men really, I would love for to see them really embrace the embodiment, the embodying that happens with Black joy, to really understand what's happening in their bodies, right? Mm-hmm. And particularly since their bodies are such a perceived threat. And so you almost like, I imagine, in my hopes and dreams that a brother that's reading this book would, hear my story of like figuring out what joy feels like. And then when he's getting pulled over, can access it, even if it's on his own mind. Right. And as we know, there's still no guarantee. Right. But at the same time, I think from a mental health standpoint, an emotional health standpoint, a spiritual health standpoint, Black men could really use the somatic portion of like joy, of the joy. Like, I mean, and I've said this, like, I feel like over and over today, but like joy by itself is simply like this physiological firing off of hormones, in our body, the dopamine, the serotonin or whatever,
right,
in response to pleasure,
mm-hmm,
right? That's, what all it is. Black joy is all of that, but it's a demonstration of our humanity, right? It's a demonstration. That's the resistance piece. You dehumanize me, my humanity shows up, right? In the form of joy. And I just, I would love a more specific, tangible. So to the person who's asking this question, like, in what ways can you, your grandsons, make them conscious of when they're happy, when they're having a joy moment? Can you say, how do you feel right now when they dunk the basketball, right? Like, how do you feel right now? Tell me what it feels like.
Yeah.
Make them aware, make them speak back to you about what they're feeling, so they have words for that joy in their body. Because when you're not around and they're confronted with something, which inevitably they will, they have words for not just the joy, but every other emotion too.
Absolutely, thank you. Donna is asking another question. What was the most challenging portion to write or grapple with, and how did you get beyond it?
I mean, my first inclination is to say that the most challenging was my discussion of my sexual abuse and sexual assault. But at the same time, I feel like I have talked about that, and that's the toe dipping that I've done in other work. So I think, honestly, the hardest, most challenging portions was the one that I read today. The ones that have to do with my lineage. The people that have passed on, my Aunt Vicky, my grandmother, my great grandmother, the great time traveler who would take me to 1908 Alabama or 1912 Alabama. Like, she jumped me in her rocket ship, with her stories, and we ride out, those were the hardest, because I think I had to sit in the grief.
Cynthia Bradley, congratulations to you. I'm researching my ancestors through Ancestry.com, the Yoruba Orishas, and the data compiled by the Mormons. I have always found joy in the things you mentioned about your grandmother. I still do. I dance and sing every day. My phrase at a party is it time to play Frankie Beverly yet? My request I give as your take My request I give as your take on Zora Neale Hurston. But I guess what maybe she's saying, what is your take on Zora Neale Hurston?
The one thing that I love about Zora is, kind of what we were talking about earlier about her being unflinching in our language, right? And choosing to write in dialect and choosing to write in our language. I just find that incredibly, I hate to use the word courageous because it shouldn't be courageous, right? But in light of
the time,
right? Like in light of the time in which she was writing, was incredibly courageous, Right. It was literally the embodiment of what I'm talking about when I say, you know, my code switching button is broken, or I am going to no longer contort myself to the system. So I think, you know, there's a million things I love about Zora, but that's one of them.
Congratulations to you, Tracy. This is from Miss Denise Turner in Newton, Mass. And Denise, you can reach me on my website.
Okay.
Oh, she was at, Cynthia said, what do you like or dislike about Zora? So, okay. Raina, how do you or can someone else push joy forward when pain slash trauma seems to overshadow it?
I can answer that by like sharing a little bit of a recent experience. I was in conversation with my therapist, Black woman, and she was saying to me, Tracy, I think, because I wrestle with fear, right? Like I am, because of post-traumatic stress syndrome, fear is this ever-present thing, yes, ever-present in my body and in my mind. And what she said was like, you've been brave in the background. Because I've always been like, when I say that I have fear, people will say, what, girl, you left Kentucky and you moved on your own, you moved and you did this and you wrote this book and you left this job and you did all of that. But I was operating in a lot of ways with, you know, yes, making these courageous moves, but fear was always in the forefront, right? And a lot of times what they observed as me kind of stepping out was actually me running from, you know? And so, but my therapist said, it feels like your fear and your courage is about to shift places. Which means your fear, it's not going anywhere because you have a history, you have a, you know, you've lived, right? So it's not going anywhere, but your courage is going to take center stage,
yes.
Right? And your fear, it will still be there, but now it has to go to the background. And so I would say that, you know, Raina, hey, Raina, I work every day at being conscious and present in my decision making and asking myself who's driving the bus.
Mm-hmm.
The language that my, you know, my therapist does use, like who is driving? Is 8-year-old Tracy driving the bus? Is 15-year-old Tracy driving the bus? Is 25-year-old Tracy driving the bus? Is 35-year-old Tracy? Or is 46-year-old Tracy driving the bus? Me today,
right?
Who is driving? Because it would, depending on who's driving, will be what, you know, they each have an agenda, they each have a need for safety in a different way, right? And so I think it's important with every decision to really be intentional about asking yourself who is in the driver's seat. And if the healing, not healed, but healing version of yourself, the most recent version of yourself is in the driver's seat, then you can choose joy even in pain. They live side by side. It's not about, you know, can I get rid of the pain and put the joy. They can live together. They,
yes,
grief
they can.
And joy are in the same container.
I just want to remind everyone that there are signed books with signed book plates available for purchase, so please make sure you do that. We have 5 minutes left. I want to read something. This is the first post that I read this morning.
Okay.
And I was like, perfect post from Dr. Yaba Blay.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, to call me Black is one of the most beautiful, incredible compliments you could ever give me.
Yes.
And I said, what a way to start my day, to start Black History Month. To you know, to start this, the hours that span between waking up and being here with you.
Mm-hmm. Powerful. Like,
very powerful.
It's the, I mean, that statement is the evidence of the alchemy that we do as Black people. Because, you know, this name, this, you know, being called Black, you know, means something else to dominant culture.
Yes.
Right. So to decide it, to say, nah, baby, that's what, you not Black? I mean, like, you know,
sorry for like, you.
Like, to own that and to live in that and to love that with, you know, all of the complexities of humanity, you know what I'm saying, that live there, is a kind of alchemy that we do daily when we choose that. When we choose Blackness, as you said, every day we're transforming what, you know, has been said about us into a reality that is, for me, glorious.
Absolutely. I think on that note, we can say goodbye. I want to thank the library. And Tracy, thank you so very, very much.
Thank you.
Wonderful collection. I'm looking forward to the next book. I want to learn more about Grammy. Yeah. Thank you, everyone that came out tonight. Mm-hmm. Hope you all stay safe. Any final words, friend?
I am just so incredibly blessed to get to talk about Blackness, to get to talk about Black joy. It is an absolute privilege, and I am so grateful. I'm grateful to you. Thank you, Bernice, just for agreeing to talk with me. Thank you, Free Library of Philadelphia. I feel like I'm on like the Grammys. Like, I'm first, I want to thank, first, I'm going to give, first, give an honor to God, who's the head of my life. You know, but yes, I thank everyone for coming out, and, you know, just I'm hoping that the book blesses you.
Lovely. Everybody stay safe. Have a good evening. Thank you, Free Library. Kisses. Mm-hmm. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.